C2SP. Number 12A.
We start today with part 3 in the chapter on science, Christian Science versus Spiritualism. And that part 3 has been already introduced in the introductory paragraph that we have taken right at the beginning of the chapter on page 70, where we have already seen we just wait until things are fixed up because of the noise that perhaps is on the tape. Well, we said that in part 3 had been introduced in the introductory paragraph on page 70, where we already have seen that point that there is but one spirit, that's the main point, and then that man is never God, but spiritual man made in God's image reflects God. So the central focus here is now to see that man reflects God, that there is only but one spirit, therefore he can never be a spirit, because a spirit is a part of the one spirit, or would be a part of the one spirit, but spirit cannot be divided up. So this leads us to the spiritual man instead of to spirits. The third part leads us to the insight that man is spiritual and not a spirit. And that brings the subject further. Man is never God, but spiritual man made in God's image reflects God. In this scientific reflection, the ego and the Father are inseparable. So this is the point. If man is not a spirit, therefore a part of God, then he reflects the whole of God, and therefore man and God are inseparable. We will see these points coming out over and over, that now she introduces us in showing that man and God are inseparable and coexist. We have, as an introductory study, then in the third part, a few points that give us a key. And number one was, here again, in the third part, science and understanding have to replace human beliefs and theories. Again, we will see that she constantly refers to science and to understanding, that is really the means of seeing that man is spiritual, whereas spiritualism says you have to die, and then you are spiritual, then you are a spirit, and then you are a mortal. So the means for progression is not through death, but through understanding, through science. So all through that fourth chapter, we had this very point, first, that she would declare in the first part what spiritual understanding is, what scientific understanding is. In the second part, she compared it, scientific understanding, with beliefs, the opposite of it. And now she comes back and shows that scientific understanding is the means, the method to the spiritual. If we see that, then we also understand point 2, through spiritual science, therefore, through spiritual science, with the accent on spiritual, error is reduced to its nothingness, is annihilated. The third part gives the aspect of annihilation, as the first part gave the analysis, the second part uncovering, the third part annihilation. And that this is so, we naturally would have to prove through the text. I'm always very hot to show that we can prove something through the text. And proving through the text means the following. We do not prove something through the text just because in the text there is one statement that would verify our statement. That's not proving through the text. You can take out of the text anything that appears once and say this is the main thing. And very often we see that students approach text interpretation that way, that they take out of a long text just one big sentence that appeals to them, and then they say this is the main point of the whole text. Whereas in a scientific interpretation, you have to see something very different. You have to see that if we say this is the piece of a chapter or this is the tone of the chapter, then the text must repeat that over and over and over and over, so as that quantity makes the quality. Then we see that it is a recurring tone, a recurring subject. And that's why I always do this. You have noticed that, and I can only advise you that if you study a text, do that too, that you make sure that you find in the text these main points, like here, annihilation, or which can be brought out naturally, not only by the term annihilation, that can be brought out through a lot of different wordings. Here I give you over a dozen that appear within those few pages, and you hear that now the text is all geared towards showing that now spiritualism, that is error, is annihilated in spiritual truth. So she says, and I just read them down, you can't make notes of it or so, but you know that you yourself can go through the text afterwards. You have a key that point two really shows the third phase of analysis and uncovering the annihilation. She says, for instance, I read them down chronologically as they appear in the text. This conviction shuts the door on death. You see, the term annihilation doesn't occur, but shuts the door on death, that's also annihilation. It's disappearing. Error is reduced to its native nothingness. Well, again, you have the term nothingness, so it's reduced to its native nothingness. The fact concerning error is its nothingness. To make nothing of error, she says, to welcome the end of error, that's also annihilation. It's always error will be wholly destroyed. The nothingness of error will appear. The end of error, when all discord will be swallowed up in spiritual truth. So it's the end of error. Mortal error will vanish, another term. The nothingness of matter will appear. Matter reaches its moral zenith in illusion, forever disappears. Errors in articled sound is forever silenced in oblivion. All matter will disappear before the supremacy of spirit. Sin, sickness, and death will give everlasting place to the scientific demonstration of divine spirit. Can you hear very easily that this third part has a completely different office, a different aim than the first part and the second part? You remember the first part was always the analysis. Something is or is not. Something can or cannot. Something has or has not. It's constantly just saying what is and what is not, so as to analyze what is and what is not, but only analyzing both sides. Then the second part was constantly saying, now we must see what is, because the phenomena are not telling us what is. They are really foxing us. We have to go back and see from where these phenomena come from. And only then can we uncover if this phenomena is or is not. You see that? That's the second part, to show, are we going to be fooled or not? So we have to uncover what is and what is not. And that whole uncovering is have we seen. Now, when it is uncovered, now comes the third phase of annihilation, and the third part is constantly showing now that which is found out in the second part as that which is not of a divine cause is an error and therefore must be destroyed. So it must be annihilated. And so it shows the method of annihilation, and it's very interesting to see that method of annihilation is not just a method of hammering on error with a hammer until it is knocked down, but that there is a more gracious way of getting rid of error and bringing error back to its nothingness. So often when I read down these various phrases here about annihilation, you could see that the term nothingness appears over and over and over, just to show that which is, and that which is not is being destroyed, is a nothingness and not a somethingness also next to the isness. Also, in order to give a sense that the method of annihilation is not really a very fearful thing, namely that everything is destroyed, you know, and you shriek under it, but Satya says, look here, no, the destruction of error is actually the appearing of truth. They go hand in hand. The more truth appears, the more error disappears. So the reduction of error to its native nothingness, Sri Vujjo, is actually the appearing of immortality. She speaks about the appearing of man's great reality, the reduction of error to nothingness is an acknowledgement actually of truth and life. It is an apprehension of spiritual reality. So there is something very positive naturally involved in the method of annihilation. Meaning only that which does not belong to reality is being annihilated, and that gives room for reality to appear and to manifest itself. This would be point two. Then we have point three, spirit. But as the overtone of the chapter, we have seen spirit is the roof category of the whole chapter, that under that tone of spirit, everything is categorized. And actually that synonym spirit will appear and appear no matter if we are in the subject of soul or of truth. It will appear and reappear because it's always going back to the roof category and showing that in the third part the necessity of the understanding of spirit and of the supremacy of spirit is necessary. So that constantly we have a great, great tone that now the spiritualization of being takes place, that spiritualization of man is being shown, so that he is not driven towards being a spirit, to be a material being, and then driving in the direction of being a spirit, but of a supremacy of spirit, as a reflection of spirit. In other terms, spiritualization. So that the whole question of spiritualization is brought out, especially we have it under point four, that the third chapter is spirit and love, and in that is the main tone of part three, postulate the final spiritualization of all things as the plan of love. You can see spiritualization, a spirit of all things in the plan of love is love. So spirit and love here wants to show that it is in the plan of love to spiritualize all things. and not to materialize spirit or not to spiritualize matter, but that really this is the main accent of the whole chapter, that it is geared towards spiritualization of man and the spiritualization of all things, so that the complete disappearing of all disharmonies before the supremacy of spirit appears. We feel already out of this that here we get, so to say, the solution of the whole chapter, that here we find the answer, so to say, to spiritualism for us. We will find the method of that solution, that whole spiritualization of all things. This tone of spirit and love is brought out in also over and over in various renderings, as for instance that she speaks about the understanding and recognition of spirit, then must finally come is the tone of love, because love is always that which forces everything towards its fulfillment. Or she says that the spiritualization will follow, for love is spirit. Here you have a very short sentence that just shows that the third part has to do with love and spirit, namely that spiritualization will follow. We also have again that sense of that will, that it will come, that it must come, that there is no other way, that there is no other method, no other chance. Love will save us. So she speaks about the final spiritualization. When something is final, you know, it's the seventh day, it's the fulfilled sense, love. Final spiritualization of all things is always a tone of love that includes all the reflections of spirit. Then that fulfillment of spiritualization is then shown as man, as a spiritual likeness of God. So that ego and the Father is one that we had in the introductory paragraph is then brought out here over and over, that man will reflect God, that man's great reality will appear. You have again that it finds its fulfillment, that the spiritual concept of man must appear, that the spiritual facts will be discerned, always this. So I think in this way there is another point, namely 5 in part 3. The standpoint is always the unity of God and man, the fact that man is God's image and likeness, that links up with the preceding question of 4, namely the unity of God and man. This is brought out also constantly, not only in that introductory paragraph where we had that spiritual man is made in God's likeness and then say that it reflects God, and therefore in this scientific reflection the ego and the Father are inseparable. That was the introduction. Here in the third part, you find these statements over and over. About a dozen times, she refers back to this fact that man is God's own likeness. You see, again showing man is the reflection of God. Man is not separate from God, therefore he is one with God. God who makes man in the image and likeness of himself, again, the self-reflection of God. Man reflects God. Man reflects infinite truth, life, and love. Man is found in the likeness of spirit, called spiritual perfect. Man is found. I just read them down like a rosary, so to say, but that's not the purpose of it. The purpose of it is to impress thought that I'm not talking about my own view of the text, but that I always try to see that science, the text itself, gives me the answer. and so that I'm not sidetracked, so to say, by my own individual likings of some statements in a text. This is always the great danger, that because up to now the reader of the textbook has never been trained in reading the textbook as a consistent, coherent whole, he could do no better than just to like some statements in the textbook, some statements that perhaps have helped him, or that he finds it's a big statement, even if it's only a subjective evaluation of it, and then they think this is the main point in a text. And that misleads the whole interpretation of a text. And we are very one-sided and are misguided in it. Yes, that's, so to say, an introduction into the whole third part. And our epitome for the whole third part is that title which we had afterwards, namely, that scientific understanding leads to the final spiritualization of all things. So we have to see now what are the steps in that unfoldment of scientific understanding that finally leads us to the oneness with God, with spirit, and not to a spirit. Then if we have found that, then we free ourselves of believing that mortals will after this be some kind of a spirit or ghost, and have still a material concomitant, still a corporeal body, still the five physical senses, that you still can hear and speak and see and see and so on. Yes, this is what we are considering now, and this whole subject is evolved through seven main stages. And when we look just with our eyes over the epitome book here, then we see at once that these seven stages have a different number of subtones, and very quickly you see that mind has three tones, spirit three tones, and soul and principle five tones, spirit four tones, truth seven tones, love seven tones. Again, we have the Genesis order. She builds up this in a Genesis order as the days of creation. When I say the Genesis order, I always refer to the order and structure of the 7 days of creation in Genesis, which is built up in the 3-3, 5-5, 4-7, 2-7. We have seen that already in the chapter on marriage. The chapter on marriage was built up in that order, and also there Mrs. Eddy made an exemption of the rule by showing the last tone of love in the 7 subtones, here also in the 7 subtones, and we have seen that this is legitimate because the 7th day of creation, which is only shown in 2, those 2 are love and truth, and not love as mind. Love as truth, and truth always refers to the whole, and therefore is a shortcut or a shorthand expression of the 5 preceding subjects. One can always take the 5 preceding subjects together and say, this is the truth about creation. And then the 7th comes and says, and this is fulfilled. So we have here the order of the days of creation. We can ask, why this order? Why not the 7 by 7? And we see, yes, again, it is a step-by-step working out of things. Our epitome for the whole third part reads that way, that scientific understanding leads to the. So we have a way, it is a becoming process, it's not an isness state of things, so it's a becoming process, and so we take the steps as they are shown in the days of creation. This is the reason for the subtones. Now, we could go to the first big subject, namely that of mind. We have here under mind the caption, the epitome, spiritualization begins when we recognize man as God's own likeness. So again we have here, where do we start? What is the beginning? So we have the first day, and therefore the Genesis order, and so that whole subject of spiritualization begins when we recognize man as God's own image. Mind in here is to recognize it, to apprehend it, to admit it, to make it our own. That's what mind does. So that is the great tone, that we begin to recognize that man is already God's own image and likeness. This is the main tone, and then we have a build-up through three subtones. The first one showing us what? The fact that man is God's own likeness must be admitted by man himself. So you have mind that understands, mind that knows, mind that apprehends. So here, mind is the admission of the final state of man. And this brings us to the text, which is the following. We have here the great statement right at the beginning that introduces the whole third part, and the statement that is so powerful that we can never forget it again. I think it is of such great importance. She says, the admission to one's self. Again, she doesn't say to oneself, but to one's self, as if she would say to one's true ego. And not just to oneself as a human being, but the admission to one's self that man is God's own likeness sets man free to master the infinite idea. This is a very impressive statement for various reasons. First of all, it is the advice how to start, namely to start with admitting first a reality, first something that is real, so that we have the admission to one's self, to our own being, so to say. What? That man is God's own likeness, so that God has his own likeness. And we begin to feel, therefore, that whole attitude is from the standpoint of science, where God has his own likeness.